let us establish well this mindfulness. So he is referring to these qualities of kindness, joy, equanimity, and compassion as dimensions of sati, or as dimensions of mindfulness. These are, of course, exactly the same phrases that are used in the Satipatthana, the teaching of mindfulness. Whether standing, sitting, walking, or lying down, let us establish this present moment recollection. You know, the more I teach and the more I study, you know, the more I see the kind of transparency of some of the divisions we make between these pathways. You know, this is an insight meditation practice, or this is a metta practice. Actually, of course, what permeates all of these pathways is this quality of establishing mindfulness in a particular way. And that is actually what we are doing with the cultivation of befriending, of compassion, of joy and equanimity. We are establishing mindfulness in a particular way, no matter how we are positioned in this life. So we're not just speaking about a kind of internal state or an internal dimension. We're talking about establishing this way of being, whether standing, sitting, walking, or lying down, no matter how we are positioned in this life. Now, I want to give you a little bit of a historical context, actually, to this, because in the development of the Buddhist teaching over centuries, something rather curious, and I would say even rather bizarre, happened to these pathways and to the Brahmaviharas. I mean, in the early teachings, and I can give you a number of textual references to this, the Buddha actually speaks about these pathways of development as being pathways of liberation, pathways of awakening that hold everything within them. Now, over the centuries, something happened, well, particularly in the first few hundred years after the Buddha's death, something began to develop in the Buddhist world where there began to develop these sort of schisms. And the schisms were one in which the Panya, or the insight traditions, were elevated over everything else. This is where there began to be the formation of Buddhist places of learning, Buddhist monasteries of learning, an emphasis upon the sutta, the learning element, over and above, or seemed to be superior as over everything else. And part of that schism was developing actually quite an attempt to preserve the Buddha's teaching, actually, through learning, through memorizing, through remembering. Now, in the establishment of the Panya, or the wisdom traditions, the Brahmaviharas eventually came to be seen as being somewhat of the poor cousins of insight. You know, insight was the real awakening factor, and here was something kind of in the side dishes on the menu, you know. And it's very interesting, certainly in my early years of practice, this is how it was presented to me, you know, that we would, you know, really work hard on the pathways of developing insight, and in the last 10 minutes of a retreat, we would have a metta practice, you know. It was almost like we could go home feeling a little bit good, you know, and it was almost really associated with a kind of feeling rather than a rigorous training and a rigorous development. Now, actually, the Buddha actually frames the Brahmaviharas, and I really want to stress this very strongly, as very powerful and subtle ways of changing our relationship to both our internal and external worlds. Now, when we look more closely at the Brahmaviharas in the early teachings, we do see them as being presented as pathways of understanding. In fact, in the Samyutta Nikaya, these are described as chetovimutti, the immeasurable liberation of the heart through the cultivation of metta, befriending, compassion, joy, and equanimity. Now, for the Brahmaviharas to be practices of awakening, pathways of awakening, and pathways of insight, there's a few key features they have to include. So they can't just be developed as, again, episodic feel-good states, which is why I say they are rigorous developments. For these qualities to be truly immeasurable, they need in some ways to be addressing the very powerful forces of greed, hatred, and delusion. Otherwise, they will not be awakening. Equally, if they are to be pathways of liberation, they need to be simultaneously developing and cultivating a very profound and liberating understanding of impermanence, instability, dukkha, and non-self. So these pathways need to have these components and these intentions within them for them to be pathways of genuine liberation rather than episodic places we visit. So I want to break down these four qualities a little bit and to look at the kind of parallel themes that run through each of them as they are taught by the Buddha. The Brahmaviharas, alive and cultivated moment to moment, they're said to be the guiding principle of all ethical actions. This is the foundation of all ethical actions. The Buddha certainly describes integrity not as following a set of rules or a set of precepts, but as a conscious cultivation of thoughts, words, and acts of metta, of kindness and befriending. Now, this conscious cultivation, you know, in terms of an ethical guideline, I think this is not something I want to spend a lot of time with, but I think any of you who have practiced a great deal, waking up is an uncomfortable process. And I think part of the discomfort of being more awake in our life is that we get very intimately and directly introduced to areas of dissonance in our life, don't we? Where there is a gap between our values and our aspirations and how we speak and how we act and how we behave in the world. And, you know, it's a part of practice. It's sometimes referred to as conscious incompetence. You know, we know exactly what's going on, but we're actually falling into those same holes over and over again. So in placing this kind of ethical framework of metta as something that is behind our thoughts and our words and our actions, the Buddha is immediately throwing down a big challenge, because this is not just about how we feel. It's about how we speak and about how we think and about how we act and how we relate and how we translate those very deep intentions and aspirations we have in this life into the very fabric of our lives and our way of being in the world. So this is what ethics is primarily concerned with. We could all learn rules until the day we die. But to live in the light of those training guidelines, those ethical commitments, for many of us, I think, is a huge challenge. But this is what, isn't it, what kind of shapes our most noble way of being in this world. This is what allows us to go to bed at night without residues of regret. What allows us to go to bed at night without the residues, if only I hadn't said that or had said that. So the Brahmaviharas are cultivating, being the guiding principle of integrity, of ethical relationship. They are trainings in intention. You know, it's sometimes said that the whole of this path rests upon the head of the pin of intention. And what we actually see in our own practice and in our own lives, how much the development of this mindfulness of intention and being able to sustain intention is what moves us out of the world of heedlessness and forgetfulness and impulse. There's a Roman philosopher who once said that, you know, we can move through life dancing like puppets on the ends of our strings, of the strings of our impulses. Which is also dancing like puppets on the ends of the strings of our habits. So this training in developing, inclining the mind towards kindness, inclining the mind towards compassion, towards joy, towards equanimity. So this is not something we're trying to contrive or to force or to pretend, but through the commitment to these qualities, we are, moment to moment, learning to incline our mind in this way. Now, the Buddha saw, and I'm sure as we're equally aware, you know, the Buddha was not alone in his insights. You know, and I find that, you know, many Westerners who come to practice come already with a great deal of insight that has been learned through their life. It is why often when we listen to the Buddha's teaching, you know, we don't have this, we don't get this sort of glazed look like says, you know, I've never heard that before, you know, or what on earth is he talking about, you know. There's a way often in which the Buddha's teaching has a sort of inner echo. It's a kind of ancient echo because it's reminding us of something that in some way we have already learnt and been learning in our life. So the Buddha saw, as just as much as I think we see, the pervasiveness of greed, hatred, and delusion that can certainly torment us individually and torments us collectively and clearly torments our world. The deeply rooted habit patterns that create and recreate suffering. So the Buddha suggested this is not a terminal condition. This is not a life sentence. He said that there is a way out of these habit patterns, and the way to the end of suffering would be to cultivate these embodied intentions of kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity. And to live in this intentional way is to begin to uproot the tendencies of greed, hatred, and delusion. So I think for any of you who practice metta, practice befriending, practice joy or compassion or equanimity, it's so important to be clear on the direction of this practice. This is a practice that is committed to uprooting the patterns of greed, hatred, and delusion. Now, an intentional life really requires mindfulness. It requires us to deeply understand in our own life the teachings of the Four Ennobling Truths, that there is dukkha, there is unsatisfactoriness in so many ways. There is a cause, there is an end, and there is a pathway to its end. And often when the Buddha speaks about this, about mindfulness, one of the similes that is used to describe mindfulness is pretty much a medical, it's a medical kind of example. And the Buddha describes it like a surgeon's instrument. You know, that if a surgeon was approaching a wound in your body where the cause was unknown, wouldn't blindly jump in, cutting and amputating and doing this, would actually kind of check this out, you know, what's going on here? What's causing this wound? Would make a diagnosis, would actually, as much as possible, deliver a prognosis and then prescribe a method of treatment. And this is how the Buddha encouraged us to approach our understanding of dukkha or pain or unsatisfactoriness. for us to know what is going on, to know what is the cause, to know the possibility of healing or liberating, and to find the pathway to bring that into being. So an intentional life, which is the second piece of these Brahmaviharas, requires mindfulness, requires the willingness and the courage, I would say, to truly look at and explore moments of distress and its causes in our world. This is already a little bit counterintuitive, isn't it, for many people? Distress? Not me. You know, how do I get away from this? How do I fix it? How do I get rid of it? You know, what's the solution? Whose fault is it? It's not always just so intuitive in us to turn towards and to say, what's actually going on here? What is the cause? So the Brahmaviharas are very much explicitly spoken of as antidotes to greed, hatred, and delusion, inclining the mind and beginning to shape the mind. This requires some efforts. Now, the third aspect, I would say, of the Brahmaviharas is that these qualities are not just concerned with inner development. This is very important, clearly. You know, that we learn this way of inner development, inner training, but they are always relational qualities. They're concerned with just and harmonious and respectful relationships, communities, and societies. What we do see is that just like mindfulness is incompatible with forgetfulness and heedlessness, you know, they are not compatible. You could try tying your shoes habitually and mindfully in the same moment, and you will see it doesn't work. But it's also true that metta, compassion, joy, and equanimity are incompatible with hatred, rage, fear, and mistrust. They do not coexist. These qualities are said to be the cause of peacemaking, the ways to heal conflict and division, the ways to bring unity in places of alienation, the ways to bring cooperation and trust between people and communities. So there's a kind of almost like a twofold development within the Brahmaviharas. It's very concerned, their development is very concerned with the climate and the landscape of our own minds and hearts. But they are also ways of widening our circle of concern, to care about the people we live with, people who are close to us, to care about the people we struggle with, that we feel disconnected from, and to learn to care about the spectrum, the myriad of beings that we don't know, that we have no personal history with, and that who may never have a direct connection to our worlds. Now, the third aspect of the Brahmaviharas is that they are meditative pathways. Now, this word meditation, of course, has become quite naturalized in our culture. It's another of the words that has been borrowed, actually, from the Gospels, because the early translators couldn't find a word in English to translate this word bhavana. So we're a little bit stuck with the word meditation. But it's too late to change it. It's too late to change it. But I would really like to encourage you to move in your own thinking from this word meditation to this word bhavana. You know, there's a very few words in Pali that are worth adopting rather than trying to translate. Because meditation sounds like something you do, doesn't it? You sit with your eyes closed, you know, and you find your cushion and you look good, you know, and you look like a real yogi, you know, and I'm doing some meditation, you know. And it's not a terrible word, you know, it's an okay word, but it doesn't really describe this dynamic of cultivation, isn't it? I mean, how does it reframe your practice, say even your formal practice, if you think of yourself as you're taking your seat on your cushion and you're cultivating? Okay, you're cultivating. It has a different connotation, doesn't it, than I'm meditating. I'm cultivating. That raises a real question, doesn't it? What am I cultivating in this moment? This is something very present moment. It's something very dynamic. And, of course, this word bhavana, you know, the Buddha being very rooted in the agrarian culture, you know, uses many of these kind of agricultural metaphors and words, you know, because it's what people could relate to at that time. They're growing something. They're on this path and they're growing something. Now, cultivating has, you know, kind of many, many different dimensions, doesn't it? It has a direction. It's like planting a seed and you're caring for that seed. And eventually that seed is going to come to maturity and fruition. It's not always a sort of dynamic that we associate with the word meditation. Okay, so that was a very long spiel to actually encourage you to make this slight shift inwardly and to sense what difference that would make in your pathway to think every time you're sitting, walking, standing, or lying down, you are engaged in cultivating something. So this quality of bhavana, this quality of cultivation, of course, it's always interwoven with mindfulness. I mean, again, it's another word we've inherited. it's always interwoven with mindfulness because it requires us to be awake to cultivate anything. You know, it requires us to be there. We need to be present. And so we all have, of course, moments of, you know, great friendliness. We all have moments of joy. We all have moments of compassion and moments of equanimity. And isn't it true they sometimes seem like accidental encounters? Yet as cultivations, they actually, you know, and the Buddha's certainly encouraging us to come out of this mind of accidental encounters. You know, it's a cultivation, this is a training, it's a naturalizing, it's a developing and bringing something to maturity. And so as a meditative pathway, these qualities require as much dedication as any other meditative pathway if they're to be brought to fruition and become unshakable, okay? This word is very important when we speak about these qualities. The Buddha speaks about the possibility of them being not only immeasurable, but unshakable. So they are present in all the changing circumstances and conditions of our lives. It is where the mind and the heart has made its home. This is home. It's not some hotel room. It's home. So we are learning through this sustained cultivation to incline the heart towards befriending, towards compassion, joy, and equanimity, until they become, with practice, the natural resting place of the heart. And where do we do this cultivation? I see a few nods. It's probably obvious. Not in the most sublime moments of our lives. Where do we engage in this cultivation? In all of the moments of ill will, all of the moments of forgetfulness, all of the moments of judgment and blame, all of the moments of alienation and fear and anxiety. It's a rigorous training that really rests upon understanding that this is the path we're engaged in, is relieving, alleviating suffering, not only internally, but externally. This is what we are committed to bringing to an end. As the Buddha put it, and this is something I think really to register in our own minds, what the mind considers and reflects and dwells upon in a sustained way, to this their mind will bend and incline. What the mind considers and reflects and dwells upon in a sustained way, to this their mind will bend and incline. To paraphrase this, what we practice a lot, we get better at. This includes ill will and anxiety and greed and fear. What we frequently dwell upon and think about becomes the shape of our mind, and very often, well, almost reliably, will become the shape of our world. It's not hard for us to see this. You know, if we dwell upon anger, impatience, ill will, or upon anxiety, becomes the shape of our mind. And how do we see the world? It's a difficult place to be in, filled with unpleasant people, or it's an anxious place to be in, filled with threat. So the Buddha is actually suggesting that each of us needs to consider where we are dwelling in every moment, where we are making our home in every moment. And of course, the great gift of mindfulness is telling us that we have choices, that we learn to incline the mind towards befriending, towards compassion, towards joy and equanimity, rather than perhaps the more familiar or habitual places of ill will or anxiety or confusion. Is that clear? Cheers. It's kind of a very simple, but I think a very profound formula. These qualities are called boundless because they are inclusive and unconditional, not limited by preferences or partiality. These qualities embrace all being. It doesn't matter how we feel about them. We don't have to like someone to embrace them with befriending and compassion and equanimity. Ajahn Sumedho once put it, he said, "It's not difficult for me to feel kindness towards things that I like, such as kittens and puppies, cute children, and pleasant people who say nice things, sunny weather, etc." He says, "I have no problem with all of this. But what should I do when people and things are nasty and foul?" And I'm sure we can all guess the teaching, the Buddha's answer to all of this. This is where we cultivate and apply the Brahmaviharas. Have a little pause moment, okay, because I realize I've already been talking for quite a while. Does anybody just have anything brief they want to raise in this moment before I sort of again give this background to all of the Brahmaviharas? Yes, please.
When we were meditating...
When you were cultivating, yeah. Yes, yes, yes. Yeah.
Yes.
We are learning to sensitize ourselves. We're learning to sensitize ourselves. We're learning to wake up. We're learning to establish a present moment recollection, which is why the Buddha kind of extolled mindfulness of the body as the primary basis of mindfulness. In fact, once said that if there is no mindfulness of the body, there is no mindfulness at all. Okay, so the Buddha's really gives a great primacy to mindfulness of the body as the starting place of beginning to wake up and as really the classroom of all insight. In fact, he said everything that can be understood will be understood within the length of this body. Okay, the mindfulness of the body is always a present moment recollection. So every moment you're actually mindful of your body, you are actually awake in this moment. You know, we don't have yesterday's migraine. We don't have tomorrow's toothache. We have what is actually happening right now in this body. So this is our starting point of beginning to sensitize to what is actually going on and to begin to cultivate that willingness to meet this present moment experience rather than leaning backward into the past or some future imagining. We're learning to actually develop that wakefulness, which is a starting point. It's not the end in itself, but it's providing the ground for wakefulness. It's good to remember that, and it's always a good question to ask, you know, what is the point of this? Because I think sometimes we just lose our way and we get almost lost in the ritual of meditating rather than the pathway of cultivating. And there's a very big difference between those two. Yeah. Okay, so the question, I'm sorry, I need to repeat the questions. So the question is the Brahma Viharas only for people or is it for?
All beings.
Well, they're all beings, okay. Can I come to that a little bit later on in the morning? If you raise something that's actually, you know, within my scheme of development, I hope you can let me develop it as we go along, and I will get to that, certainly. Yes, sorry. Sati. Sati is the Pali word for mindfulness. Again, mindfulness is another word that was borrowed from the Gospels because, again, the early translators just could not find a word that captured the nuances of this word, sati. So, again, it's another word where we're not going to get rid of it. You know, we need to live with it. It's become a very mainstream word in our culture. Everybody does a little mindfulness, you know. But it's very important to understand what sati means because it is a very multidimensional word. And to just do it very briefly, if I could mention four aspects of sati. One is the developing this simple knowing that you referred to when we sit down on a cushion and we're mindful of the body and we're mindful of the body, of the mind. We're starting to develop both a vocabulary for experience and a relationship to experience, okay? So it's a simple knowing. Oh, a thought's happening. Oh, sadness is happening. Oh, a sound is happening. So it's that simple knowing in which nothing is added to it. Please abolish the phrase bear attention from your vocabulary. It's not bear attention, okay? And bear attention, some of you are familiar with. Okay, this was brought into the lexicon of meditative definitions by Jnana Panika, who actually regretted it half an hour later. Even though it's become absorbed into meditative language, he regretted it because there's no such thing as bare attention. Attention always has a flavor. There's skillful attention, there's unskillful attention. When we're very angry, we're sometimes most attentive moments of our life. When we're very greedy or lost in lust, nobody has to tell us to pay attention. So attention is never bare. So it's this dimension of simple knowing. A simple knowing of experience, okay? The second dimension of sati is what is called a protective awareness, and I will go into this more later on. It's learning to protect the heart, to protect the mind from the surges of impulse and habit that so easily overwhelm. The third dimension is a kind of investigative awareness, using that medical metaphor that I just gave you. And the fourth dimension, the fourth primary dimension of sati, mindfulness, is learning to reframe cognition, reframe our narrative, our views. Okay, so that sounds complicated, but it's almost kind of like re-perceiving. Rather than our perceptions drawing on history and habit and reactivity, it's almost re-perceiving. I could give you a very, very simple example of this. Some weeks ago, I was eating at a restaurant in London. It was quite a small restaurant. And there were four quite young children, you know, 4 to 8, running around screaming at the tops of their voices, you know, knocking things over. It was not a big place, you know, so this was, and you could sort of feel this collective aversion arising in the restaurant. And, I'm sure quite a few people were having quite a few thoughts about this. It was very palpable. It was very palpable. And, I started to notice myself, you know, just about 20 minutes in, I thought, you know, maybe somebody really ought to be kind of reining these kids in a bit. It's not even safe. And then I realized I couldn't see their parents. And I looked around the corner to see where their parents were. And it was a group of deaf women. That's what we talk about, reframing cognition. How we can have a view, a story, a narrative that's built upon not knowing how things actually are. And how when we come to perhaps perceive again and see things as they actually are, how it was such a sort of poignant example for me of that movement from this story about how things are that's filled with aversion and impatience to actually reframing the narrative that allows for compassion and empathy and kindness. So those are the four dimensions of sati or mindfulness. So when you use the word mindfulness, I really encourage you to really think of those nuances. Yes, please. Bhavana, 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 to bring into being, to cultivate, to grow. Okay, shall we just move on a little bit, I think for about another 15 minutes, and then we'll take some time for some walking and a drink if you need one. Does that work for everybody? Yeah, you'll probably be ready if we need to keep refreshing our energy here. So I've talked about ethics, I've talked about intentionality, I've talked about inclining the mind, I've talked about training. These are all aspects of these qualities as pathways of development. I've talked about their inclusive, their unconditional nature. So one last piece I want to talk about is I think something that's deeply unpopular actually in our culture, I've noticed. In fact, I sort of expect tomatoes to be thrown or something along those lines, because I've noticed that this piece of the teaching, and it's not mine, please, this is so. Please don't blame me. This was actually the Buddha who taught this, you know, and he's not here to blame. So, but I just want you to think about this, because the Buddha was primarily an ethicist. You know, he was actually not concerned with metaphysics. He was not concerned with other worlds. He was primarily concerned with how we live this life we have. And part of that ethical framework, it was very much concerned with what we do. In fact, the Buddha really redefined the word karma, which was, you know, very much prevalent at that time and very much interpreted as being results of action. You know, you have your karma, you know, or, you know, which was actually, it's another word. But the Buddha actually really redefined almost this word karma and put it central in the teaching, because it's about what we do. It's about how we live and what informs what we do, how we act, how we respond as we move through this world. And the Buddha recognized this is not just about what we feel. It's about what we're committed to. And in this sense, what we feel in that moment really is something to be investigated. It's not something to be dismissed, but it is something to be investigated. Because I feel ill will or anger, is not a justification and it's not a mark of authenticity for me to move through this world carried by that impulse. So, you know, and I'm very aware in our culture, you know, that there's a kind of mythology of authenticity, I think, is what I call it. You know, that if I feel something, that makes it true or it makes it right. You know, and as far as I can see, we live in a world where people have no problem expressing what they feel. You know, if I walk down the street and see somebody kicking tires or honking their horns at drivers, you know, or you know, all the ways, things that we encounter in this world, I don't think people have any problem expressing what they feel. And this is not a measure of freedom, is it? It's often a measure of being governed by the predominant mind state of the moment. So the Buddha actually reframed our direction in life of not being governed by we feel, recognizing that mind states, emotions come and go. Some of them are skillful and wholesome, and some of them are really not skillful or wholesome in that they create and recreate suffering. And the Buddha asks us, you know, to set our heart on a more ennobled way of being in this world, recognizing that we're always practicing something in this life, you know, whether we're sitting, standing, walking, or lying down. And in the absence of mindfulness or commitment to aspiration, it's very possible that what we practice in this life are our most familiar and tired habit patterns of reactivity. Have you noticed it's not difficult, that it doesn't take much effort to practice the unwholesome? This is always astonishing me, you know. Like, I don't have to make an effort to be irritated. You know, I really don't have to make an effort to be confused, you know. I don't have to get up in the morning and think, well, I'm really going to try hard today to be depressed or impatient. It comes pretty easily, doesn't it? And isn't this the nature of habit patterns, is that they are so well practiced that they actually don't need much effort anymore? They're kind of default mechanisms where we've learned to make our home. But it takes considerable effort, doesn't it, to actually live a life in line with our deepest intentions and aspirations. That actually requires an ongoing, renewed commitment, a renewed intentionality, a renewed sense of nourishing those aspirations, almost a renewed setting of ourself on this path. And that's why I say when the Buddha described himself as an ethicist, he was really concerned with this moment-to-moment way of being in this world, his moment-to-moment way of responding, really being very caring about what we do and where it arises from, and really questioning whether the predominant mind state or emotion of the moment really should be endowed with the authority to guide our way of being with ourselves or with others or with the world. That takes some courage to question that, because we can be quite self-righteous, can't we, about our habit patterns. You know? Of course I'm angry. Yeah. Of course I need that. We kind of exempt ourselves. There is unmistakably a behavioral element in the teaching of the Buddha. It was not just concerned with, you know, kind of exalted states of experience or exalted states of mind. He basically proposed that these mean very little if they are not translated into our thoughts and our words and our acts and our relationships. And that can feel quite hard, can't it? It can feel quite challenging, you know. And you know, certainly in my early years of practice, I myself and everyone around me was chasing exalted states of mind. And, you know, we got quite a few, actually. It's not like we were entirely unsuccessful. But when I then came down off my mountaintop and found myself on a bus and punching the guy behind me who was grabbing my rear end, I actually thought, these exalted states of mind, there's a little bit of a gap here. You know, and what does it really mean to be on my mountaintop or my cave? I mean, we can be a really good sociopath sitting in a cave, you know, and just actually not knowing how to live in this world. And when we think of the challenge of swimming against the tide of greed, hatred, and delusion, and translating, you know, and being an ethicist ourselves, you know, deeply concerned with how we live, how we move, how we engage, how we respond, then I think we experience both the landscape of this path, and, you know, it can feel very big. Except then we remember that this is a present moment cultivation. We're not cultivating tomorrow's compassion. You know, we're not cultivating tomorrow's joy. We're not cultivating next year's kindness that's going to come about after we've worked out all of our difficulties and our ill will. We're actually talking about what we're cultivating this moment. And I want to just end with reading this one aspect of the discourse on boundless friendliness. With friendliness for the whole world, should one cultivate a boundless heart, above, below, and all around, without obstruction, without hate, and without ill will. Standing, walking, or sitting, or lying down, whenever one is awake, may one stay with this recollection. This is called the most noble way of living in this world, here and now. When we hear that, I think it sounds like a very big ask. And I think, you know, we are sometimes very ambivalent about entertaining the possibilities of this path for ourselves as something that is actually means something to ourselves. But it's always important to remember, first of all, that the Buddha always sought for graduates. The Buddha didn't seek for followers or endless students. The Buddha sought for graduates and for people to come to exactly the same understandings and exactly the same fruitions as he had come to in his own life. And it's also important to remember that even though it seems perhaps like a very big ask to abide every moment in our waking day with immeasurable friendliness, compassion, joy, and equanimity, the size of the task can only ever be equal to the size of the moment. It's not bigger than that. It is not bigger than that. We don't practice yesterday's metta or rehearse next year's equanimity. We can only ever tend to the mind and the heart of this moment. And we don't begin with boundless, unshakable, immeasurable friendliness, compassion, joy, and equanimity. We begin with those qualities that can feel quite boundaried, that can feel quite episodic. But the genius of the Buddha's teaching was to build upon what we already know. We have all tasted moments of unhesitating friendliness, tasted moments of joy, tasted moments of unhesitating compassion, of reaching out to another in pain. We've all tasted moments of equanimity, and we need to learn from those tastes to recognize that those seeds live within each of us. No one is excluded. No one is left out. That those seeds live within each of us, and a pathway of cultivating is cultivating those capacities that are already here. No matter what state of development they are in, they ask for that caring, that tending, that building upon what we have already glimpsed and known in our own experience. Okay, so I think that's a good place for us to pause for the moment.